The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you. And today, a guest returning to the program who we haven't had on for a number of years. In fact, he was just starting to break out as an author the last time we had him on. And now he is one of the top-selling writers in the world of American fiction. His name is John Sanford. His Prey series keeps getting stronger and stronger, and the new book is called Extreme Prey. John Sanford will join us to talk about it coming up in the Book Nook this morning, but first, NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today I'm thrilled to welcome back to the program John Sanford. Hello, John.
How are you?
Excellent. Much better now that I've got you on the line. I just finished this book, this new book, Extreme Prey. Oh, man, you know, for a couple of Iowa guys like us, you're from Cedar Rapids, I'm from Des Moines. This is just like reading about my life.
Yeah, it's sort of, I know that territory fairly well. I have driven it hundreds of times. I used to go down to Des Moines from Minneapolis, and they take that left turn into Cedar Rapids where my brother still lives. So, I'm pretty familiar with the place.
I imagine we have a couple listeners out there who aren't familiar with this particular series, John. You want to give them in a nutshell what the series is about and who your protagonist is?
Sure. I've written 26 books in what's called the Prey series about a Minnesota cop named Lucas Davenport. He is started out as a detective with the Minneapolis Police Department. He eventually moved to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which is Minnesota's equivalent of the FBI. And then he recently, in the last book before this one, quit the BCA and doesn't have a job. In this book, he is, during the time he worked for the BCA, he did a number of political jobs for the governor, who is an extremely liberal Minnesota Democrat, and that very much resembles real life. So then he's not working as a cop anymore, and he's up working on his cabin in Wisconsin, putting on an extension to his cabin, when the governor calls him and wants him to come to Iowa. The governor's running for he's running in the Iowa primaries. He's running for the presidency. He knows he's not going to get it because he's far too liberal, but he's hoping to get the vice presidential nomination. The main Democratic candidate is a woman named Mykella Bowden, somewhat very kind of shallowy. Modeled on Hillary Clinton, and the governor realizes along the way that there are some people out there who pose a threat to Mrs. Bowden, and he's not sure how serious the threat is, but he's got a really bad feeling about it. So he calls up Lucas and asks Lucas to come down just as kind of an informal investigation in to see if there really is a threat, and it turns out there's a very serious threat, and that's what drives this book.
And the story, most of it takes place in Iowa in various towns, and there's a lot of political maneuvering going on, and everywhere that Lucas goes in this first book where he's not really a cop, when people see him, they go, "You're a cop."
Yeah, because he looks and acts like that. He can't he can't really escape his past.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, his whole attitude is like that, but he finds out a couple of times that he's not a cop. You know, he goes to question somebody and they tell him to take a hike.
And as the story opens, we, as readers of this series and of your writing, we know right away that this woman that is butchering a rabbit, you tell us in so many ways that she's going to be a bad person that's, you know, kind of psychotic. And she's become sort of deranged by the farm crisis of the 1980s. This is really inspired by the farm crisis in many ways, isn't it? A lot of people probably don't remember that, but in Iowa in the mid-1980s, these were hard times for farmers.
Yeah, the 1980s were really a brutal time if you lived out in the countryside. There was both an economic crisis and a financial crisis at the same time where the value of the commodities was low to begin with. And then there was a financial crisis in which people couldn't get financing from the banks, to pay for seed corn, to pay for their crops, to keep going for another year. And a lot of people, huge numbers of people, lost their farms. As a matter of fact, the Twin Cities had a big growth spurt back about that time, and most of that spurt came from people who were being driven off their farms and had to go to the cities to find jobs. But in any case, she lost her farm. Her husband subsequently committed suicide. Her son went to Iraq during the oil wars and was injured there. And then she saw more people that she knew losing their homes during the financial crisis of 2008-2009. So she's lived through a sequence of events in which she felt powerless and which she felt were perpetrated on her and her friends and her neighbors and really the people in the entire Midwest by bankers, by politicians who didn't care about them, about all the usual suspects. And she has a tendency towards psychosis anyway, and this just feeds it. Then her son, when he was in Iraq, was near a couple of explosions by these improvised explosive devices and essentially artillery shells that are set off by cell phones. And he wasn't exactly wounded, but he was injured. His brain was injured by the nearness of the explosion. So he has got some functional problems as well as his mother's problems. And together, they kind of form this little teeny cult, two-person cult, who think they can change the world with an assassination. And that's the story. And then the question... You know, since it's a thriller, you know who the bad guys are.
Mm-hmm.
You can see him driving toward their objective. The question is Davenport going to get there in time? And in the course of my series, there have been a number of instances in which Davenport didn't get there in time. In which a number of bad things happen. Davenport makes mistakes. He sometimes goes down the wrong trail. He chases the wrong person. So there is sort of a mystery element, the question of whether he's going to get there in time. And I won't give away the answer in this case, but I think the story's got a lot of drive to it. And in kind of an odd way, because I started writing this a long time ago, in an odd way it sort of reflects the real kind of tension and the awfulness of this current political campaign right now. I mean, this is the roughest campaign and in some ways the most depressing campaign I can remember since the 1960s.
And I would guess that when you knew this book was going to come out now, you probably presumed that the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee would already been chosen. But wow, yeah, you're right. This is an amazing campaign. Very strange. The book is Extreme Prey. John Sanford wrote it. And you're hearing about this wonderful new novel on the Book Nook today, and we have a very special bonus for you this morning. We have a segment from the audiobook of Extreme Prey, in which John introduces the psycho killers from his novel, and you just heard him talking about them. a woman named Marlis, who lives on a little acreage in rural Iowa, and one of her sons, a veteran of the war in Iraq named Cole. Let's listen now to Richard Ferrone reading from the audiobook for Extreme Prey as we meet Marlis and Cole.
Marlis was a woman of ordinary appearance, if seen in a supermarket or a library, dressed in homemade or Walmart dresses or slacks, a little too heavy but fighting it, white-haired, ruddy-faced. In her heart, though, she housed a rage that knew no bounds. The rage fully possessed her at times, and she might be seen sitting in her truck at a stoplight, pounding the steering wheel with the palms of her hands, or walking through the noodle aisle at the supermarket with a teeth-baring snarl. She had frightened strangers who might look at her and catch the flames of rage, quickly extinguished when Marlis realized she was being watched. The rage was social and political and occasionally personal, based on her hatred of obvious injustice, the crushing of the small and helpless by the steel wheels of American plutocracy. Jesse walked into the kitchen, running a hand over his close-cropped hair. He peered over her shoulder into the sink. "What are we having?" "Rabbit fettuccine Alfredo," Marlis said to her blue-eyed son. "We're eating early, 'cause I gotta get over to Mount Pleasant. You go on out and get me some broccoli and a tomato. Where's your brother?"
"Messing around with that 22, Jesse said. He put a hand to his left cheek, a gesture of thought, a weariness in others, but in Jesse, an unconscious move to cover the port wine stain that marked his neck and the bottom of his cheek. "He says there's nothing wrong with it that a good cleaning won't fix."
"Well, he knows his guns. Go get me that broccoli. We'll eat in an hour."
Marlis and her younger son, Cole, lived on a 9-acre place north of Pella, Iowa, in a weathered, clabbered farmhouse with 3 bedrooms and a bathroom up, a living room, parlor, half-bath and kitchen down, and a rock-walled basement under all of that. The basement held the mechanical equipment for the house and a 21-cubic-foot whirlpool freezer that Marlis filled with corn, green and wax beans, peas, carrots, cauliflower, and broccoli, which kept them eating all winter. Applesauce from a half-dozen apple trees went in ball jars stored on dusty wooden shelves next to the freezer. Her older son, Jesse, until recently, had lived in an apartment in town with his wife and daughter and sold Purdy produce at most of the big farmers' markets between Cedar Rapids and Des Moines. Cole worked in the truck gardens and ran the mower at the country club during golf season. The two sons would jacklight 4 to 6 deer during the various hunting seasons, and the venison steaks and sausage, supplemented by the rabbits, filled out their meat requirements. They'd once had a chicken yard, but a midwinter spate of accounting several years earlier had convinced Marlis that chickens were cheaper to buy at the supermarket than to raise at home, even given the bonus eggs. In the winter, to raise cash, Marlis made hand-stitched quilts that she sold through an Amish store in Des Moines. She wasn't Amish, but nobody much cared as long as the quilts moved. The Purdys weren't rich, but they did all right, not counting the possibly inherited tendency to psychosis. Jesse walked down to the closest garden, cut a few broccoli heads. They were big and tough, being the last harvest of the first season, but good enough when chopped, and got a nice ripe tomato. All of that took only a minute, but by the time he started back to the house, he was sweating. There'd been a lot of rain that spring, and everything was looking lush and fine. At the moment, the sun was shining and the temperature was in the low 90s, with the humidity close to 80%. The local farmers, of course, were bitching because the bean and corn harvests were going to be huge and the prices depressed. Of course, if it hadn't rained, they'd be bitching because their crops were small, even if the prices were high. You couldn't win with farmers. For Marlis and her sons, the frequent rain was nothing but a blessing,
more food than they could eat, so many apples that they'd have to cull them before they were mature to keep the apple tree branches from breaking. Enough raspberries and Concord grapes to make jam for 5 years of toast. Marlis had been talking of buying an upright freezer for the kitchen. She could freeze a year's worth of cinnamon apple slices, and they all did like apple pie. As Jesse walked back to the house, he noticed a pale haziness on the western horizon above the afterglow left by the sun, hinting of a new weather system moving in, even more rain. All right with him. Looking up at the top floor of the house, he saw Cole sitting behind the bedroom window screen with his rifle, which he had reassembled.
"You don't go shooting nobody," he called up to his brother.
Cole didn't say anything, but lifted a hand. Gray-eyed Cole sat in his bedroom window looking out over the road, a scoped Ruger 10/22 in his hands. Squirrel rifle. Below him, a quilt hung on the wire clothesline airing out. Before the end of the day, the quilt would smell like early summer fields with a little gravel dust mixed in. A wonderful smell. A smell like home. An aging green pickup was motoring over the hill to the south, about to take the curve in front of the house. Cole tracked it with the scope, watching David Souther horse the truck around the curve heading south toward Pella. He whispered to himself, "Bang!" One dead Souther. Souther was a hippie kind of guy and had 120 acres given over to sheep, which he'd shear so his wife could wash, spin, dye, and weave the fleece into blankets and wall hangings, which they sold at a store at the Amana colonies. Souther was also a poet and sometimes had a book published. The Purdys had two of his books, which Souther had given them, but Cole had never read any of the poems. Cole had nothing at all against Souther or his wife. They worked hard, and they didn't get rich, but they did all right, he supposed. Jeanette Souther was the shyest woman Cole had ever met. She couldn't even look at another human being. How she and Souther had ever gotten together, he had no idea. Of course, they had no kids, so maybe they hadn't exactly gotten together. Souther being a poet and all. Another truck came over the hill to the south. Cole put his scope on it. Cole had been to Iraq twice with the National Guard. He'd been a truck driver, not a combat troop, but in Iraq, even the truck drivers were on the front lines. He'd been in his truck on two occasions when IEDs went off at the side of the road, once a short distance ahead of him, once behind him. Artillery shells fired with cell phones. He hadn't exactly been wounded either time, but he'd been hurt. He couldn't hear anything for a while after the second explosion, and never could hear as well as he had when he enlisted. Right after the IEDs, he'd been too dizzy to drive for a bit and nauseated for a couple of days, but the Army told him that he was okay, and the VA had waved him off. They had more important things to do. He wasn't entirely sure about how okay he really was. Hadn't been able to sleep since he got back, and that was 9 years now. And he'd had a bell-like ringing in his ears since the first explosion, sometimes so loud that he thought it would drive him crazy. And maybe it had. The approaching truck went into the turn. Sherm Miller, who had a farm up the road, 960 acres, one of the richer people around. His land alone probably worth 7 or 8 million. Cole whispered, "Bang."
I had a friend back in the mid-1980s who was going to the University of Iowa, where you graduated, and he was looking for a cheap apartment. And he didn't want to pay Iowa City prices, so he found an apartment in a little dusty town just outside Iowa City called Hills, Iowa. And I was absolutely blown away when you decided to put a bunch of your action in Hills. And knowing your journalistic background, I have to guess that you chose that particular community because that was a flashpoint in the farm crisis back in 1985.
Well, the other thing is when I went to the University of Iowa, I got an apartment in Hills. So I'm familiar with the town. I lived there for a year and a half. The woman who lives in Hills got a big garden outside of her house. That's my wife's garden.
Oh my!
And we also had a big grape arbor that was there that was created by the owner of the house we were living in. And he said we could have the grapes if we'd give him half the wine that we made from it. So we made like 55 gallons of wine from the grapes on the arbor. That was a kind of an interesting year there in Hills. And it is a small town, and it's a pretty interesting place, actually.
And in 1985, a distraught farmer, probably psychotic, walked into the bank and killed the bank president because he was freaking out about his debt to the bank.
You know, I think I remember that. I think I remember reading that story at the time.
Yeah. Well, that was my connection. I didn't realize you had lived there, John. That's just one of those bizarre coincidences.
It's not, you know, I think it's 11 miles from, I think it's 11 miles from Hills to Iowa City. So it's not, it's not really an obvious place to live, but that is kind of an interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
I will tell you a story, which I probably shouldn't tell you.
Okay.
I'm very much sort of anti-drugs. I think drugs are just kind of a curse on the American landscape. But when I was a college student, I would occasionally smoke a little weed. And there was one instance where I had gotten a little high and probably shouldn't have been driving, but I drove to Hills. It took me an hour and a half. It was like 11 miles. All I could remember about the trip was I kept looking at the moon because the moon looked like it was about 35 feet across. I mean, I was just amazed, but it just took me forever to get there. But
wow, that's a great story, John. Thank you. The book is Extreme Prey. John Sanford joins us, and as we get to the end of the story, of course, I'm not going to say what happens, but. This turns into kind of a bridge novel because this is his first one where Lucas is not really a cop, but we can see a possibility of Lucas becoming a cop again by the end of this and starting a whole new kind of career.
Yeah. You know, I'm doing that for tactical book reasons. One of the problems that I've had is that for the past few years, Lucas has become almost a manager. And he hasn't been, you know, that he tells other people to do stuff, and they do stuff, and then he does some stuff, and then they do some stuff. I wanted to isolate him a little bit more. Mm. I want him to be sort of one-on-one with the bad guys. And I wanted to kind of get his family out of it, because I'm sensing that his family isn't all that interesting, you know, to a lot of readers. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to make him a really hardcore U.S. Marshal. But he's a special kind of marshal, and I don't want to explain why he's a special kind of marshal, because that would give away part of the end of this book. But he is going to be a guy who is essentially gets a political appointment to be a marshal, and he's told that he can do what he wants, any place in the country and maybe any place in the world. And that gives me a lot of freedom to send him, you know, all over the country to do different kinds of things with different kinds of people, and also gets him away from his home milieu a little bit. The one aspect that's going to be missing is that most people in thrillers and in most thriller books, and people like this, is that there's a romance, and Davenport will still be missing that romantic part where he develops a relationship. And you find that in most thrillers and that's still going to be sort of missing from this. On the other hand, probably the most popular thriller writer in America right now is Lee Child.
Mm.
And his novels, there is no romantic element. There was a slight romantic element in one novel, and maybe in two.
The Woman in Virginia.
Yeah, Woman in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And that's the only ones, I think, in which, and even then, it was just sort of a slight attachment. He didn't spend a lot of time with the relationship. And I really like Lee's books a lot. And so, maybe you can get away with that without that romantic attachment. And I guess I'm going to find out, because Lucas is going to be going after somebody like the worst of the worst now. And I think it's going to be sort of an interesting experiment.
Well, with Lee Child's creation, Jack Reacher, we're always waiting for him to choreograph the next fight where he takes on 11 guys and decides how he's going to choreograph that, you know, battle. Forget the love interest.
Yeah, it's just he has been in a number of interesting fights, as a matter of fact.
My guess is John Sanford, his book is Extreme Prey, and the Iowa caucuses are that first in the nation thing that make all these candidates go there and try to go to all 99 counties. It's just crazy, and they all go to the Iowa State Fair. And I thought it was brilliant for you. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the climax of this Extreme Prey novel is taking place at the Iowa State Fair. And what a perfect place to be an anonymous assassin.
Yeah, the day that I was there, for 2 days, actually, but the main day that I was there was a nice, warm, sunny day and not too hot. And I was told later that there were 109,000 people in the fairgrounds, and they were going through the fairgrounds that day. Well, I mean, you know, Des Moines is like 250,000, I think, so this is like half the town, except that they're not from Des Moines. Iowa's got a very rural fair. I mean, it seems like people from all the state, from everywhere, are jammed in there. And, you know, you see, I was wearing my Hawkeye hat, and you see guys wearing, you know, Iowa State hats and Hawkeye hats and Drake and you know, all the other colleges and stuff. And it really is a whole state fair, more than any place, I think, even than in Minnesota. Minnesota has a really terrific state fair, but there's a very large urban element to it. And Iowa's fair is pretty rural. I mean, it's got, the swine barn and the horse barn and the cattle barn and all those places are pretty prominent, much more so than, say, in Minnesota, where they're kind of a sideshow compared to all the other stuff that they've got there, since it's in a huge urban area, the fair is. But I'll tell you what, I spent, you know, half an hour in the swine barn just looking at the pigs, and you can't believe how clean and neat and dressed up they get those things, and it's pretty amazing.
I believe it, John, because I've been in the swine barn many times.
Well, I'll tell you the thing that I have never seen, and I've been in a few cattle barns in my life, I didn't realize that they had dedicated cattle showers until I went there. It's this woman in there giving her cow a shower, and I said, okay, that's what I didn't know about. So.
Yep. Well, in my mind, the biggest difference between the Iowa State Fair and the Minnesota State Fair in St. Paul is that the Minnesota State Fair, they have those deep-fried cheese curds.
Yeah, well, those are good, but they had deep-fried Twinkies at the Iowa.
Right.
Yeah, so that's pretty much of a toss-up, I'd say.
Yeah. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And we have another little audiobook bonus for you. I was just talking to John about Lucas going to the Iowa State Fair, where the climax of this thrilling novel, Extreme Prey, takes place. And Lucas is cruising around the Iowa State Fair. He's looking for these psychotic killers. They think these killers are going to try to do something to one of the presidential candidates. And this is from the very end of the story, as Lucas is cruising around the Iowa State Fair trying to find these psychotic killers. Here's the audiobook version of Extreme Prey, as read by Richard Ferrone.
Lucas climbed out of the gator and slapped it on the back bed, and Greer took off. Lucas had been to the Minnesota State Fair 6 times in his adult life, 3 times as a uniformed Minneapolis cop, and, years later, 3 more times at the insistence of his adoptive daughter, Letty, who brought along 3 hot female friends in skimpy clothing who ignored Dad. Now, as he walked past the hulking grandstand and through the midway rides, it all began to come back. He really didn't like state fairs. Small, out-of-the-way county fairs were okay with their traveling carny shows that might have been taken from a Stephen King short story, and their weird idiosyncratic events like speed chainsaw sculpture, 1 minute to do a 4-foot bear, and snowmobile water skipping. A big institutional fair was just that, institutional. Sure, deep-fried ice cream bars might be a good idea, but after you've eaten a few, then what? As he probed the midway, circling around the rides and the games, he looked at faces. Iowans, on the whole, were probably not any heavier than Minnesotans, but there were a lot of heavy people around and a lot of tall guys. Marlis Purdy would be hard to find in a crowd simply because she was short. As the crowds grew thicker, she'd be submerged in moving flesh. Cole would be easier to spot because he was 6 feet tall and thin and would stand out in the crush. Lucas approved of posting the photos at the gates, but had little faith in the idea that a guard would spot the mother and son. The most he could hope for, he thought, other than a lucky identification, was that they were still outside the fairgrounds, that the photos would warn them away and they wouldn't try to come inside, so Bowden would be safe. They could always catch the Purdys later. But they probably knew they were being hunted. If they were the ones who'd killed Joe Likely, they'd have known about Lucas for several days. Even if they had only known about him since Lucas first talked to Marlis, they would still have been warned. The fact that they'd sent Jesse to jail suggested that they knew that they were going to be identified and would be prepared for it. So either they were already inside, or they had a plan to get through the gates. Any reasonable plan, Lucas thought, as he peered at a teenage boy who was tall and thin but wasn't Cole, would probably work. Lucas had come out of the midway and was crossing the concourse when the radio in his pocket vibrated, and he pulled it out and put the speaker to his ear, and a female voice, a little breathless, said, "Possible identification of Cole Purdy walking toward gate 14, about to enter midway. I'm in pursuit with John Allen. We will stay in touch until we get more people here." Another woman's voice came up and said that cops were being routed to the area. Lucas pulled the map out of his back pocket and, after a few seconds, spotted gates 14 and 15 back the way he'd just come. He turned and ran back that way, the radio in his hand. He was maybe 300 yards away, he thought. A minute or more, having to circle and dodge his way through the crowd pouring in the opposite direction. The radio buzzed again, and he put it to his ear and heard the woman say, "He's right there by the ticket booth. See him? Green long-sleeved shirt and cutoffs." Another voice, "We got him. Okay. We see you and John. We're coming in." "We'll move on him now," the woman said. "Careful." Lucas arrived a minute later to find a circle of people around 2 plainclothes cops and 2 highway patrolmen, all focused on a thin, long-haired man who was leaning with his hands against the side of a ticket booth while the cops looked through his wallet. He resembled Cole, Lucas thought, but his eyes were brown and his nose too big. The man next to him, who was carrying a soft drink cup the size of a bucket, said, "For a minute, I thought it was a terrorist attack." Lucas started to back away as the thin man argued with the cops. Greer was pulling up in his green and yellow John Deere gator, and he'd know the man wasn't Cole. A good-looking blonde bumped into Lucas's holstered gun as he tried to extricate himself from the crowd. He glanced down at her and saw in her eyes that she knew what it was, and he grinned, held up the handset, and whispered, "Cop." And she apparently saw that in his eyes and nodded and said, "Good." And, "What's going on?" "We're looking for a guy, but that's not the guy." Then he was in the open again, and having been prompted by the good-looking blonde, noticed that he was surrounded by good-looking blondes. They were everywhere. So many blondes, so little time on Earth. He headed back up the midway. At the end of it, he looked down to his right. That was the concourse. He'd have to walk down that later anyway, so he turned to his left and followed a much less crowded street past a miscellany of buildings, and at the end looked past a gate and over an extensive campground. The Purdys could have spent the night there, he thought, and have gone through the gate as soon as they opened with a crowd of other early birds. He had to remember that they came to the fair in most years, according to Jesse, so they'd know the place well. He got close enough to the gate to see the pictures of the Purdys posted on the glass walls, then turned and wandered back the way he came, took the first left, walked under a cable car, past a big barn-like building with a red dome, then stopped to watch some people throwing horseshoes at a horseshoe court. Hadn't seen anyone playing horseshoes in years, maybe decades. He was still watching when he felt somebody watching him and turned to see two cops ambling up, but ambling with purpose. He held up the handset and they stepped over and one of them asked, "Who you with?" Lucas handed him the DCI identification folder and the cop glanced at it and handed it back and said, "Saw the bump under your shirt." "I figured," Lucas said. "I understand there was some excitement over at the Midway," the cop said. "Wasn't him," Lucas said. "Resembled him, but wasn't him." The other cop looked around and then said, "You know what? Not one guy in 100 looks like him. But there are going to be 100,000 people here today, maybe more. Half of them will be male. If it's 1 in 100, that's 500 guys who'll look like him. How in the heck are we supposed to pick him out?" The first cop said, "He'll be the only one shooting Mrs. Bowden." Lucas had to laugh, bumped the cop with his elbow, and said, "I didn't hear that." The other cop was now looking at the horseshoe court and said, "You know, I could see playing horseshoes, but I'll be damned if I could see practicing horseshoes." Lucas said goodbye to the cops, worked his way past grandfather's barn, and 15 minutes later walked through the swine barn, which was on the far south edge of the fairgrounds. The swine were looking pretty good in their maze of pens, all freshly washed and odor-free, some with curly tails, some without, some cheerful, some not, most of them asleep. From there, he walked through the cattle barn, watched a woman giving a shower to a steer in a dedicated cow shower. He hadn't seen that before, and found it interesting. He had heard rumors that in Texas, they actually shaved their cattle before showing them at the state fair. He wasn't sure about the credibility of the report, but it sounded like something Texans might do.
You have another series that is kind of spun off of this one, and it's a series that features Virgil Flowers, and Lucas and Virgil make little cameos in the other series. Do you want to talk about that series? Because I'm sure you have another book coming out in that one, probably, what, in 6 months?
In September, late September, early October. I don't think the publication date's been set yet, but I'm about 10 days from finishing that one, and it's a pretty typical Virgil Flowers in that, you know, things are very confusing and weird. And it's a little lighter series than the Davenport series. There are still really bad guys in it, but Virgil is sort of a lighter kind of guy. He's not as dark as Davenport. He doesn't tend to brood about a lot of stuff, and he doesn't like guns very much, so he usually lives in the car. And he tends to be involved is really workaday life isn't really homicide. It's really stuff like strange crimes that happen out on the prairie. You know, people like one woman, you know, used a saw, a sawzall, to cut through the side of a Walmart truck, and she stole like 1,000 pounds of baby diapers.
Uh-huh.
And he tends to solve crimes like that, but then every once in a while a murder will come along, and that's the ones that we look at in the books. And so in the new book, what happens is that two tigers get stolen from the Minnesota Zoo, and people believe that they're about to be processed for traditional Chinese medicine, and that, in fact, is what is happening.
Oh.
And I've got the main bad guy is a pretty interesting character who's seriously hooked on Xanax, and it's the only way he can keep his problems under control. So most of the time, he's about ready to take a nap because he's so stoned on Xanax. So it's sort of a strange book, but not uninteresting, I think.
Well, I love both series, and you're right. Virgil, he's a little lighter. He's got, for one thing, he's got an eye for the ladies, and for another thing, he's such a classic Minnesota guy. This is a guy who, when he goes to a crime scene, he'll haul along his fishing boat just in case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you got to do that. I mean, you have your boat with you. And he is, he's got kind of long hair, and he wears cowboy boots, and he does have an eye for the ladies, and he's been married 3 times and divorced 3 times, and his current love interest is a woman who was once led kind of a life of crime. In a sense, she would sell fake antique lumber on the West Coast, and he once investigated her because some guy complained that he bought old Barmlander, turned out to be 5 years old, and so. Anyway, he is a lighter character, and I really enjoy writing those books, too.
My guest is John Sanford. His new Extreme Prey novel just came out, and he's going to be going out on a short little book tour this week, hitting Scottsdale, Pasadena, Sacramento, and then the Twin Cities, Roseville and Minneapolis, on his itinerary. And we're so lucky to be able to track him down for this interview. And John, I've read a lot of your books, but I had never listened to one on an audiobook, and I noticed that you've had the same guy read a number of these Prey books, a guy named Richard Ferrone. And so I listened to Extreme Prey on the audiobook version, and I absolutely loved it.
He is a serious talent. I mean, he really is. He's as a matter of fact, I think he's even won awards for reading some of the books, but he is really an interesting talent.
My guest is John Sanford. His book is Extreme Prey, and we're interviewing him on his iPhone. We're getting a little iPhone resistance there. iPhones are part of this story because you observe how whenever something bad happens, suddenly all these people are standing there videotaping it with their iPhones. This is kind of bizarre, isn't it?
Well, it is bizarre, but you know that it happens all the time now. And the world has changed so much since iPhones came out. You know, the police have to be more careful now. They can't work with kind of the same kind of looseness they used to. Everything has gotten very technical. Everything is being filmed all the time. I mean, it's really a little bit strange. I don't know what to say about it. It's just, and the other thing is that it makes it harder to be a thriller writer when you find out everybody who has an iPhone. If you dig around in the bottom parts of your iPhone, I can't even explain this, but I did see it. There's a thing in there that will have everything iPhone has done in the last five or six days. Every place it's been.
Mm.
So you could actually look in the bottom of your iPhone and find out where you've been for the last 4 or 5 days, which, of course, would be an enormous help to cops. If you say, you know, I was in Minnesota last week, and they can show that your iPhone had been in Iowa. It's just an odd thing. And I don't even think that most people know it's even in there, but it is.
And, of course, we have a company manufacturing them that is trying to keep them from being used in certain ways where law enforcement can access information. For instance, the people in California who had the iPhones that were locked.
Well, you know, I actually am a big freedom of speech guy, and I don't like the idea that telephones can be seized. But on the other hand, if you told Apple that they couldn't use any location, they couldn't put any location stuff in their phones, and they couldn't use it for anything, and all of a sudden it turned out that they couldn't be used for advertising or couldn't be used for commercial purposes, I suspect that they might be singing out of the other side of their mouth. It's all right for me to get push advertisements for the latest computer printer that I want to buy, but it's not okay for the FBI to look. So there are lots of different sides to that question too.
My guest today has been John Sanford. His new Prey novel is Extreme Prey, and I'll tell you, John, you were really hitting it this time on this one, man. I mean, I love all your books, but this one, maybe it's the Iowa thing because I relate so much to Iowa, but I just could not read it fast enough. And I love the ending. This is one of the most diabolical plots I've read about in a long time.
Okay, well, thank you. I like being credited with diabolical plots. So,
yeah, it's brilliant. We can't figure it out, but eventually, Lucas, the light comes on, and Lucas is like, "Oh no." And it's brilliant. Yep. It's really brilliant.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, John.
And the Book Nook will come your way again tomorrow morning on Sunday at 10:30. We're going to dip into our Book Nook archive for the best of the Book Nook. Back in 1998, I had a couple of guests on the program who are currently candidates for the Republican nomination for president. Ted Cruz has never been on the show, but Donald Trump has. And so has Governor John Kasich. Back in November of 1998, Governor Kasich was Congressman Kasich, and a very influential one at that. And he had a new book out called Courage is Contagious, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Things to Change the Face of America. He came out to Yellow Springs for an interview, and I got to meet him in person. And he was very charismatic. And with his current status as one of the remaining candidates who won't drop out of the race, he's hanging in there until the convention in Cleveland, I thought it might be fun to listen to the interview that I did with John Kasich 18 years ago, because he is in the headlines every single day. In fact, in the New York Times this week, there was an article with the headline, "Ted Cruz, John Kasich Alliance Against Donald Trump Quickly Weakens." In this article, it reads, quote, "The temporary alliance between Senator Ted Cruz and Governor John Kasich of Ohio, formed to deny Donald J. Trump the Republican presidential nomination, was already fraying almost to the point of irrelevance on Monday, only hours after it was announced to great fanfare. With the PAC, the two candidates agreed to cede forthcoming primary contests to each other. Mr. Kasich would, most crucially, stand down in Indiana's primary on May 3rd to give Mr. Cruz a better chance to defeat Mr. Trump there, while Mr. Cruz would leave Oregon and New Mexico to Mr. Kasich. It appeared to be a measure of last resort, but initially it seemed like a breakthrough. Mr. Cruz trumpeted what he called the big news in Indiana, a state that appears pivotal to stopping Mr. Trump from winning a majority of delegates. John Kasich has decided to pull out of Indiana to give us a head-to-head contest with Donald Trump," the Texas senator said. But at his own campaign stop in Philadelphia on Monday, Mr. Kasich tamped down Mr. Cruz's triumphalism. "Voters in Indiana," Mr. Kasich said, "ought to vote for me." Even if he would not be campaigning publicly there, he added, "I don't see this as any big deal." Under the best of circumstances, the arrangement between Mr. Cruz and Mr. Kasich would seem to be a long shot, more of an expedient to stop Mr. Trump from taking a big step toward winning the nomination next week in Indiana than a permanent joining of forces. Far from forming any kind of unity ticket,
Mr. Trump's surviving challengers have both vowed to triumph in an open convention in Cleveland, and they remain irreconcilable on key matters of policy. Their agreement dealt only with three states, leaving an open question as to how directly they might compete with each other everywhere else. That from the New York Times. John Kasich, very much in the news, and we're going to listen to that interview tomorrow morning at 10:30. Hope you can tune in as John talks about a book he published back in 1998, and it's a very inspiring book. It's called Courage is Contagious: Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Things to Change the Face of America. And during the interview, I asked John Kasich if he was planning to run for president. And he said, yes, he was. Of course, that was 18 years ago. It took him a while, but he's very much in the thick of it this year. Who knows? He could be our next president. That's the best of the book, Nook, tomorrow morning, Sunday, at 10:30.